I was, believing Josie would come anywhere by herself. I put a mug in front of her. "I don't understand. Why did you come without Dad?" She took a sip of the tea. "Oh, that's lovely. You always did make the best cup of tea." She put it on the table, carefully sliding a paperback book under it first. "Well, I woke up this morning and I thought about all the things I had to do. Put a wash on, clean the back windows, change Grandad's bedding, buy a toothpaste. And I just suddenly thought, no, I can't do it. I'm not going to waste a glorious Saturday doing the same thing I've done for 30 years. I'm going to have an adventure." "An adventure?" "So I thought we could go to a show."
"A show?"
"Yes, a show. Louisa, have you turned into a parrot? Mrs. Cousins from the insurance brokers says there's a stall in Leicester Square where you can buy cheap tickets on the day for shows that aren't full. I was wondering if you'd like to come with me."
"What about Trina?" Mum waved a hand.
"Oh, she was busy. So what'd you say? Shall we go and see if we can get some tickets?"
"I'll have to tell Lily."
"Then go and tell her. I'll finish my tea. You can do something with that hair of yours and we'll head off. I've got a one-day travel card, you know. I might just hop on and off the underground all day."
We got half-price tickets to Billy Elliot. It was that or a Russian tragedy. And Mum said she'd been funny about Russians since someone had given her cold beetroot soup and tried to pretend that was how the Russians ate it. She sat rapt beside me for the entire performance, nudging me and muttering at intervals.
"I remember the actual miners' strike, Louisa. It was very hard on those poor families. Margaret Thatcher, do you remember her? Oh, she was a terrible woman. Always had a nice handbag, though."
When the young Billy flew into the air, apparently fueled by his ambitions, she wept quietly beside me, a fresh white handkerchief pressed to her nose. I watched the boys' dance teacher, Mrs. Wilkinson, a woman whose ambitions had never lifted her beyond the confines of the town, and tried not to see anything of my own life. I was a woman with a job and a sort of boyfriend, sitting in a West End theatre on a Saturday afternoon. I totted these things up as if they were little victories against some foe I couldn't quite identify. We emerged into the afternoon light, dazed and emotionally spent.
"Right," said Mum, tucking a handbag firmly under her arm. Some habits die hard. "Tea at a hotel. Come on, we'll make a day of it."
We couldn't get into any of the grand ones, but we found a nice hotel near Haymarket with a tea selection that Mum approved of. She asked for a table in the middle of the room and sat there remarking on every person who walked in, noting their dress, whether they looked like they came from abroad, their lack of wisdom in bringing small children, or little dogs that looked like rats.
"Well, look at us," she would exclaim every now and then when it grew quiet. "Isn't this nice?"
"We ordered English breakfast tea. Mum, that's just posh for normal tea, yes? None of those weird flavours. And the afternoon tea fancy plate. And we ate tiny crustless sandwiches, little scones that weren't as good as Mum made, and cakes in gold foil." Mum talked for half an hour about Billy Elliot, and how she thought we should do all this once a month or so, and she bet that my father would love it if we could get him down here.
"How is Dad?"
"Oh, he's fine. You know your father." I wanted to ask, but was too afraid. When I looked up, she was gazing at me a little beadily.
"And no, Louisa, I am not doing my legs. And no, he's not happy. But there are more important things in life."
"What did he say about you coming here today?"
She snorted and covered it up with a little coughing fit. "He didn't believe I was going to. I told him about it when I brought up his tea this morning and he started to laugh. And if I'm honest with you, it annoyed me so much I got dressed and I just went."
My eyes widened.
"You didn't tell him?"
"I already had told him.
He's been leaving messages on this phone all day, the idiot."
She peered at the screen, then tucked it neatly back into her pocket. I sat and watched her fork another little scone delicately onto her plate. She closed her eyes in pleasure as she took a bite.
"This is just marvellous."
I swallowed. "Mum, you're not going to get divorced, are you?" Her eyes shot open.
"Divorced? I'm a good Catholic girl, Louisa. We don't divorce. We just make our men suffer for all eternity."
I paid the bill and we disappeared to the ladies, a cavernous room of walnut-coloured marble and expensive flowers, overseen by a silent attendant who stood by the basins. Mum washed her hands twice, thoroughly, then sniffed the various hand lotions lined up against the sink, pulling faces in the mirror depending on what she liked. I shouldn't say so, given my opposition to the patriarchy and all, but I do wish one of you girls had a nice man. I've met someone, I said before I realised I'd said it. She turned to me, a lotion bottle in her hand. You haven't. He's a paramedic. Well, that's smashing. A paramedic. That's almost as useful as a plumber. So when are we going to meet him? I faltered. Meet him? Oh, I'm not sure it's what? Well, I mean, it's early days. I'm not sure it's that kind of... My mother unscrewed the lid of her lipstick and stared into the mirror. It's just for sex. Is that what you're saying? Mum? I glanced at the attendant. Well, what are you saying? I'm not sure I'm ready for a real relationship just yet. Why? What else have you got going on? Those ovaries won't go in the freezer, you know. So why didn't Trina come? I said, hurriedly changing the subject. She couldn't find a sitter for Tom. You said she was busy. Mum's eyes darted across to my reflection. She pressed her lips together and snapped her lipstick back into her handbag. She seems to be a little cross with you right now, Louisa. She activated maternal X-ray vision. Have you two had a falling out? I don't know why she always has to have opinions about everything I do. I heard my own voice, the sulky tones of a 12-year-old. She fixed me with a look. So I told her. I sat up on the marble basin, and Mum took the easy chair, and I told her about the job offer and why I couldn't possibly take it, and how we had lost Lily and found her again, and how she was finally beginning to come out of the other side. I've arranged for her to meet Mrs. Traynor again. So we're moving forward. But Trina just won't listen. Although if Tom were going through half the same thing, she'd be the first person saying I couldn't walk away from him. I felt relieved telling my mother. She, of all people, would understand the ties of responsibility. So that's why she's not talking to me. My mother was just staring at me. Jesus, Mary and Joseph, have you lost your mind? What? A job in New York with all the trimmings, and you're sticking around here to work in that god-awful place at the airport? Did you hear this? She turned to the attendant. I can't believe she's my own daughter. Honest to God, I wonder what happened to the brain she was born with. The attendant shook her head slowly. No good, she said. Mum, I'm doing the right thing. For whom? For Lily. You think nobody other than you could have helped that girl back on her feet? Well, did you speak to this chap in New York and ask him whether you could defer the job off for a few weeks? But it's not that kind of job. How would you know? You don't ask, you don't get. Isn't that right? The attendant nodded slowly. Oh, Jesus. When I think about it, I... The attendant gave my mother a hand towel, and she fanned her neck vigorously with it. Listen to me, Louisa. I've got one brilliant daughter, stuck at home, weighed down with responsibility because she made a bad choice early on. Not that I don't love Tom to bits, but I'll tell you, I want to cry my heart out when I think of what Trina could have become if she'd just had that boy a bit later. I'm stuck looking after your father and granddad, and that's fine. I'm finding my way. But this should not be the most you have to look forward to in your life, you hear me? Not a bunch of half-price tickets at a fancy tea every now and then. You should be out there. You're the one person in our family with an actual ruddy chance. And to hear you've chucked it away for the sake of some girl you barely even know. I did the right thing, Mum. Maybe you did. Or maybe it wasn't actually an either-or situation. You don't ask, you don't get, said the attendant. There, this lady knows. You need to get back there and ask this American gentleman, is there any way you can come along a bit later? Don't look at me like that, Louisa. I've been too soft on you. I haven't pushed you when I should have done. You need to get yourself out of that dead-end job of yours and start living. The job is gone, Mum. Gone, my pearly handled backside it is. Have you actually asked them? I shook my head. Mum huffed and adjusted the scarf around her neck. She pulled 2-pound coins from her purse and pressed them into the hand of the attendant. Well, I have to say you've done a grand job. You could eat your supper off this floor. Oh, and it smells simply gorgeous. The attendant smiled at her warmly and then almost as an afterthought held up a finger. She peered out of the door, then walked to her cupboard, unlocking it swiftly with a bunch of keys. She emerged and pressed a bar of floral soap into Mum's hand. Mum sniffed it and sighed. Well, that is just heaven. Just a little piece of heaven. For you. For me? The woman closed Mum's hands around it. Well, aren't you the kindest? May I ask your name?
Maria.
Maria. I'm Josie, and I'm going to make sure I come back to London and use your toilet the very next time I'm here. Do you see that, Louisa? Who knows what happens when you break out a little? How's that for an adventure? And I got the most gorgeous bar of soap from my lovely new friend Maria here.
They clasped hands with the fervency of old acquaintances about to be parted, and we left the hotel. I couldn't tell her. I couldn't tell her that the job haunted me from the moment I woke until I went to sleep. Whatever I said to anyone else, I knew I would always regret to my bones missing the chance to live and work in New York. Though no matter how much I told myself there would be other chances, other places, this would be the lost opportunity I carried, like a cheap handbag I regretted buying wherever I went. And sure enough, after I had waved her off on the train to my no doubt bemused and blustering father, and long after I had made a salad for Lily from bits that Sam had left in the fridge, when I checked my email that night, there was a message from Nathan. Can't say I agree, but I do get what you're doing. I guess Will would have been proud of you. You're a good person, Clark. Kiss.
Chapter 24. These are the things I learned about being a parent, while not actually being a parent. That whatever you did, you would probably be wrong. If you were cruel or dismissive or neglectful, you would leave scars upon your charge. If you were supportive and loving, encouraging and praising them for even their smallest achievements, getting out of bed on time, say, or managing not to smoke for a whole day, it would ruin them in different ways. I learned that if you were a de facto parent, all these things applied. But you had none of the natural authority you might reasonably expect when feeding and looking after another person. With all this in mind, I loaded Lily into the car on my day off and announced that we were going to lunch. It would probably go horribly wrong, I told myself, but at least there would be two of us there to shoulder it. Because Lily was so busy staring at her phone with her earphones plugged in, it was a good 40 minutes before she looked out of the car window. She frowned as we approached a signpost. This isn't the way to your mum and dad's.
I know.
Then where are we going?
I told you, to lunch.
When she had stared at me long enough to accept that I wasn't going to elaborate, she squinted out the window for a while. God, you're annoying sometimes. Half an hour later, we pulled up at the Crown and Garter, a red brick hotel set in 2 acres of parkland about 20 minutes south of Oxford. Neutral territory, I had decided, was the way forward. Lily climbed out and shut the door emphatically enough to send me the message that this was actually still quite annoying. I ignored her, put on a slick of lipstick and walked into the restaurant, letting Lily follow. Mrs. Traynor was already at a table. When Lily saw her, she let out a little groan. Why are we doing this again?
Because things change, I said, and propelled her forwards.
Lily! Mrs. Traynor rose to her feet. She had evidently been to the hairdresser, and her hair was once again beautifully cut and blow-dried. She was wearing a little makeup too, and those two things conspired to make her look like the Mrs. Traynor of old, self-possessed, someone who understood that appearances were, if not everything, at least the foundation of something.
Hello, Mrs. Traynor.
Hi. Lily mumbled. She didn't reach out a hand, but positioned herself at the seat beside mine. Mrs. Traynor registered this, but gave a brief smile, sat down and summoned the waiter. This restaurant was one of your father's favourites, she said, placing her napkin on her lap. On the rare occasions I could persuade him to leave London, this is where we would meet. It's rather good food. Michelin starred. I looked at the menu. Turbot quenelles with a frangipane of mussels and langoustine. Smoked duck breast with cavolo nero and Israeli couscous, and hoped very much that as Mrs. Traynor had suggested this restaurant, she would pay.
Looks a bit fussy, said Lily, not lifting her head from the menu.
I glanced at Mrs. Traynor. That's exactly what Will said too. But it is very good. I think I'll have the quail.
I'll have the sea bass, Lily said, and closed the leather-bound menu.
I stared at the list in front of me. There was nothing here I even recognised.
What was rutabaga?
What was ravioli of bone marrow and samphire? I wondered if I could ask for a sandwich.
Are you ready to order?
The waiter appeared beside me. I waited as the others reeled off their choices. Then I spotted a word I recognised from my time in Paris.
Can I have the jus de boeuf confit?
With the potato gnocchi and asparagus?
Certainly, madame.
Beef, I thought. I can do beef. We talked of small things while waiting for our starters. I told Mrs. Traynor that I was still working at the airport but was considered for a promotion, and tried to make it sound like a positive career choice rather than a cry for help. I told her Lily had found a job, and when she heard what Lily was doing, Mrs. Traynor didn't shudder, as I had secretly been afraid she might, but nodded. "That sounds eminently sensible. It never hurts to get your hands dirty when you're starting out." "It's not got any prospects," Lily said firmly, "unless you count being allowed to move on to the till." "Well, neither does having a paper round, but your father did that for 2 years before he left school. It instills a work ethic." "And people always need tins of frankfurters," I observed. "Do they really?" said Mrs. Traynor, and looked briefly appalled. We watched as another table was seated beside us, an elderly woman lowered with much fuss and exclamation into a chair by two male relatives. "We got your photograph album," I said.
"Oh, you did! I had wondered. Did you like it?"
Lily's eyes flickered towards her. "It was nice, thank you," she said. Mrs. Traynor took a sip of her water. "I wanted to show you another side of Will. I feel sometimes as if his life has been taken over by what happened when he died. I just wanted to show that he was more than a wheelchair, more than the manner of his death." There was a brief silence. "It was nice, thank you," Lily repeated. Our food arrived and Lily grew silent again. The waiters hovered officiously, filling water glasses when their levels fell by a centimetre. A breadboard was offered, removed, and re-offered 5 minutes later. The restaurant filled with people like Mrs. Traynor, well-dressed, well-spoken, people for whom Turbot Quinnell's was a standard lunch and not a conversational minefield. Mrs. Traynor asked after my family and spoke warmly of my father. "He did such a very good job at the castle." "It must be strange not going back," I said, then winced internally, wondering if I'd breached some invisible line. But Mrs. Traynor just gazed at the tablecloth in front of her. "It is," she agreed and nodded, her smile a little tighter, then drank some more water. The conversation carried on like this through our starters, smoked salmon for Lily, salad for Mrs. Traynor and me, stalling and moving forward in fits and starts like someone learning to drive a car. It was with some relief that I saw the waiter approach with our main courses. My smile disappeared as he placed my plate in front of me. It did not look like beef. It looked like soggy brown discs in a thick brown sauce. "I'm sorry," I said to the waiter. "I ordered the beef." He let his gaze hang on me for a moment. "This is the beef, madame." We both stared at my plate.
"Joue de bœuf," he said.
"Beef cheeks."
"Beef cheeks?"
We both stared at my plate and my stomach did a little flip.
"Oh, of course," I said. Yes, beef cheeks.
"Thank you." Beef cheeks. I was too afraid to ask from which end they came. I wasn't sure which could be worse. I smiled at Mrs. Traynor and set about nibbling my gnocchi. We ate in near silence. Mrs. Traynor and I were both running out of conversational options. Lily spoke little, and when she did say something, it was spiky, as if she were testing her grandmother. She toyed with her food. A reluctant teen dragged along to a too fancy lunch with the grown-ups. I ate mine in small forkfuls, trying not to listen to the little voice that kept squeaking in my ear.
"You're eating cheeks! Actual cheeks!"
Eventually, we ordered coffee. When the waiter had gone, Mrs. Traynor removed her napkin and put it on the table. "I can't do this any longer." Lily lifted her head. She looked at me and back at Mrs. Traynor. "The food is very nice, and it's lovely hearing about your jobs and all, but this really isn't going to move us forward, is it?" I wondered if she was going to leave, whether Lily had pushed her too far. I saw the surprise in Lily's face and realized she was thinking it too. But instead, Mrs. Traynor pushed away her cup and saucer and leaned forward over the table. "Lily, I didn't come to impress you with a fancy lunch. I came to say I'm sorry. It's hard to explain how I was when you turned up that day, but that unfortunate meeting was not your fault, and I want to apologize that your introduction to this side of your family has been so inadequate." The waiter approached with the coffee, and Mrs. Traynor lifted her hand without turning. "Can you leave us for 2 minutes, please?" He backed away swiftly with his tray. I sat very still. Mrs. Traynor, her face taut and her voice urgent, took a breath. "Lily, I lost my son, your father, and in truth I probably lost him some time before he died. His death took away everything my life was built on. My role as a mother, my family, my career, even my faith. I have felt, frankly, as if I descended into a dark hole. But to discover that he had a daughter, that I have a granddaughter, has made me think that all might not be lost. She swallowed. I'm not going to say that you've returned part of him to me, because that wouldn't be fair on you. You are, as I've already grasped, very much your own person. You've brought me a whole new person to care about. I hope you'll give me a second chance, Lily, because I would very much like... No, damn it. I would love for us to spend time together. Louisa tells me you're a strong character. Well, you should know that runs in your family. So we'll probably butt heads a few times, just as I did with your father. But essentially, if nothing else comes of today, you must know this. She took Lily's hand and gripped it. I'm so very glad to know you. You've changed everything so much by simply existing. My daughter, your Aunt Georgina, is flying over next month to meet you, and has already been asking if the two of us might go over to Sydney and stay with her at some point. I have a letter from her for you in my handbag. Her voice dropped. I know we can never make up for your father not being here, and I know I'm not... Well... I'm still climbing out of things, rather. But do you think, perhaps, you could find some room for a rather difficult grandmother? Lily stared at her. Might you at least give it a go? Mrs. Traynor's voice cracked slightly on the last sentence. There was a long silence. I could hear the beating of my heart in my ears. Lily looked at me. And after what seemed like an eternity, she looked back at Mrs. Traynor. Would you want me to come and stay with you? If you wanted to, yes. I would like that very much. When? When can you come? I'd never seen Camilla Traynor anything less than composed, but at that moment her face crumpled. Her other hand crept across the table. After a second's hesitation, Lily took it. And they gripped each other's fingers tightly across the white linen like survivors of a shipwreck, while the waiter stood holding his tray, unsure when he could safely move forward again. I'll bring her back tomorrow afternoon. I stood in the car park as Lily hung back by Mrs. Traynor's car. She had eaten two puddings, her chocolate molten pot and my own. I had completely lost my appetite by then, and was casually examining the waistband of her jeans. You're sure? I wasn't sure which of them I was directing this to. I was conscious how fragile this new entente cordiale was, how easy it would be for it to flare up and go wrong. We'll be fine. I don't have work tomorrow, Louisa, Lily called out. Samir's cousin does Sundays. It felt odd leaving them there, even if Lily was beaming. I wanted to say no smoking and no swearing, and maybe even, how about we do this some other time? But Lily waved and climbed into the passenger seat of Mrs. Traynor's Golf with barely a backward glance. It was done. Out of my hands. Mrs. Traynor turned to join her. Mrs. Traynor, can I ask you something? She stopped. Camilla, I think you and I are beyond formalities, don't you? Camilla, did you ever speak to Lily's mother?
Ah, yes, I did.
She stooped to pick up some tiny weed out of the border. I told her I was hoping to spend a lot of time with Lily in the future, and that I was quite conscious that in her eyes I was no kind of maternal role model, but that, frankly, none of us appeared to be ideal in that role, and it would behove her to think carefully, for once, about putting her child's happiness before her own. My jaw might have dropped a little. Behove is an excellent word, I said when I could speak.
It is rather, isn't it?
She straightened. The faintest hint of mischief glinted in her eyes.
Yes, well, the Tanya Horton Millers of this world hold no fears for me. I think we'll rub along just fine, Lily and I.
I made to move back to my car, but this time Mrs. Traynor stopped me. Thank you, Louisa. Her hand lay on my arm.
I didn't do... You did. I'm very much aware that I have an awful lot to thank you for. At some point, I hope I can do something for you.
Oh, you don't need to, I'm fine. Her eyes searched mine, and she gave me a small smile. Her lipstick, I noticed, was perfect.
Well, I'll ring you tomorrow about dropping Lily home.
Mrs. Traynor tucked her handbag under her arm and walked back to her car, where Lily was waiting. I watched the golf disappear, and then I called Sam. A buzzard wheeled lazily in the azure sky above the field, its enormous wings suspended in the shimmering blue. I had offered to help him finish some bricklaying, but we had done one row. I had handed him the bricks. The sultry heat was such that he had suggested we had a cold beer during our break, and somehow, after we had lain back in the grass for a while, it had proven impossible to get up again. I had told him the story of the beef cheeks, and he had laughed for a full minute, trying to straighten his face when I protested that if they had only called them something else, and I mean, it's like being told you're eating chicken buttock or something. Now I was stretched out beside him, listening to the birds and the gentle whisper of the grass, watching the peach-coloured sun slide gently towards the horizon, and thought, when I was managing not to worry whether Lily had used the word pussy-whipped yet, that life was not all bad. Sometimes, when it's like this, I think I might not bother building the house at all, said Sam. I might just lie in a field till I get old. Good plan. I was chewing a grass stalk. Except the rainwater shower is going to seem a lot less appealing in January. I felt his laugh, a low rumble. I had come straight to him from the restaurant, inexplicably unbalanced by the unexpected absence of Lily. I didn't want to be in the flat alone. When I had pulled up in the gateway of Sam's field, I had sat as my car engine ticked its way to sleep and watched him, content in his own company, scraping mortar onto each brick and pressing it to the next, wiping the sweat from his brow on his faded T-shirt, and I had felt something in me unwind. He had said nothing about the slight awkwardness of our last few conversations, and I was grateful. A solitary cloud drifted across the blue. Sam shifted his leg closer to mine. His feet were twice the size of my own. I wonder whether Mrs. T has got her photographs out again. You know, for Lily. Photographs? Framed pictures. I told you she didn't have a single one of Will anywhere that time Lily and I went to her house. I was quite surprised when she sent the album because a little bit of me had wondered if she'd destroyed them all. He was silent, thinking. It's odd. But when I thought about it, I don't have any pictures of Will on display either. Maybe it just takes a while to be able to have them looking at you again. How long did it take you to have your sister by your bed again? I never took her down. I like having her there, especially looking like she used to look. He lifted his arm above his head. She used to give it to me straight. Typical big sister. When I think I've got something wrong, I look at that picture and I hear her voice. Sam, you great lunk, just get on with it. He turned his face towards me. And you know, it's good for Jake to see her around. He needs to feel that it's okay to talk about her. Maybe I'll put one up. It would be nice for Lily to have pictures of her dad in the flat. The hens were loose and a few feet away, two of them shivered into a patch of dirt, ruffling their feathers and wiggling, sending up little clouds of dust. Poultry, it turned out, had personalities. There was the bossy chestnut, the affectionate one with the piebald comb, the little bantam that had to be plucked out of the tree every evening and put to bed in the coop. Do you think I should text her to see how it's going? Who? Lily. Leave them. They'll be fine. I know you're right. It's weird. I was watching her in that restaurant, and she's so much more like him than I first realized. I think Mrs. Traynor, Camilla, could see it too. She kept blinking at Lily's mannerisms, like she was suddenly remembering stuff Will did. There was this one time when Lily raised an eyebrow and neither of us could take our eyes off her. She did it just like he used to. So what do you want to do tonight? Oh, I don't mind, you choose. I stretched out, feeling the grass tickle my neck. I might just lie here. If you happen to fall gently on top of me at some point, that would be okay. I waited for him to laugh, but he didn't. So, shall we talk about us? Us? He pulled a blade of grass through his teeth. Yeah, I just thought, well, I wondered what you thought was going on here. You make us sound like a maths problem. Just trying to make sure we don't have any more misunderstandings, Lou. I watched him discard the grass and pick up a new blade. I think we're good, I said. Well, I'm not trying to accuse you of having a neglected child this time or a trail of imaginary girlfriends. But you're still holding back. It was gently said, but it felt like a kick. I pushed myself up on my elbow so that I was looking down on him. I'm here, aren't I? You're the first person I call at the end of the day. We see each other when we can, and I wouldn't call that holding back.
Yep. We see each other, we have sex, eat some nice meals.
I thought that was basically every man's dream relationship.
I'm not every man, Lou.
We gazed at each other in silence for a minute. I no longer felt relaxed. I felt wrong-footed, defensive. He sighed.
Don't look like that.
I don't want to get married or anything.
I'm just saying, I've never met any woman who wanted to talk less about what might be going on.
He shaded his eyes with his hand, squinting slightly into the sun.
It's fine if you don't want this to be a long-term thing.
Well, okay, it's not, but I just want an idea of what you're thinking.
I guess since Ellen died, I've realized life is short.
I don't want...
You don't want what?
To waste time on something that isn't going anywhere.
Waste time? Bad choice of words. I'm not good at this stuff.
He pushed himself upright.
Why does it have to be anything? We have fun together. Why can't we just let it run and, I don't know, see what happens?
Because I'm human, okay? And it's hard enough to be around someone who is still in love with a ghost without them also acting like they're just using you for sex.
He raised his hand, covering his eyes.
Jesus Christ, I can't believe I just said that out loud.
My voice, when it emerged, cracked a little.
I'm not in love with a ghost.
This time he didn't look at me. He pushed himself to a seated position and rubbed his face.
Then let him go, Lou.
He climbed heavily to his feet and walked off to the railway carriage, leaving me staring behind him. Lily arrived back the following evening, slightly sunburned. She let herself into the flat and walked past the kitchenette, where I was unloading the washing machine, wondering for the 15th time whether to call Sam, and flopped onto the sofa. As I stood at the counter and watched, she put her feet on the coffee table, picked up the remote, and flicked on the television.
"So how was it?" I said after a moment had passed.
"Okay." I waited for something more, braced for the remote control to be hurled down, for her to stalk off, muttering, "That family is impossible!" But she simply changed channels.
What did you do?
Not much. Talked a bit. Actually, we gardened. She turned round, resting her chin on her hands on the back of the sofa.
Hey, Lou, have we got any of that cereal with the nuts left? I'm starving.
Chapter 25. Are we talking?
Sure. What do you want to say?
Sometimes I look at the lives of the people around me, and I wonder if we aren't all destined to leave a trail of damage.
It's not just your mum and dad who fuck you up, Mr. Larkin.
I gazed around me like someone suddenly handed clear glasses and saw that pretty much everyone bore the brutal imprint of love, whether lost, whipped away from them, or simply vanished into a grave. Will had done it to all of us, I saw now. He hadn't meant to, but even in simply refusing to live, he had. I loved a man who had opened up a world to me but hadn't loved me enough to stay in it. And now I was too afraid to love a man who might love me in case...
In case what?
I turned it over in my head in the silent hours after Lily had retreated to the glowing digital distractions of her room. Sam didn't call. I couldn't blame him. What would I have said anyway? The truth was that I didn't want to talk about what we were because I didn't know. It wasn't that I didn't love being with him. I suspected I became slightly ridiculous around him, my laugh goofy, my jokes silly and puerile, my passion fierce and surprising even to myself. I felt better when he was there, more the person I wanted to be, more of everything. And yet. To commit to Sam was to commit to the likelihood of more loss. Statistically, most relationships ended badly. And given my mental state over the past 2 years, my chances of beating the odds were pretty low. We could talk around it. We could lose ourselves in brief moments. But love ultimately meant more pain, more damage, to me or worse, to him. Who was strong enough for that? I wasn't sleeping properly again,
so I slept through my alarm and despite tearing my way up the motorway, arrived late for Grandad's birthday. In celebration of his 80 years, Dad had brought out the fold-away gazebo we had used for Thomas's christening, which flapped mossy and listless at the end of the garden where, through the open door that led to the back alley, a succession of neighbours popped in and out, bringing cake or good wishes. Grandad sat in the middle of it all on a plastic chair, nodding at people he no longer recognised, occasionally gazing longingly towards his folded copy of the Racing Post. So this promotion. Trina was on tea duty, pouring from an oversized pot and handing out cups. What exactly does it mean? Well, I get a title, I balance the till at the end of every shift, and I get to hold a set of keys. This is a serious responsibility, Louisa, Richard Percival had said, bestowing them with as much gravitas and pomposity as if he were handing me the Holy Grail. Use them wisely. He actually said those words. Use them wisely. I wanted to say, what else am I going to do with a set of bar keys? Plough a field? Money? She handed me a cup and I sipped at it. £1 an hour extra? She was unimpressed. And I don't have to wear the uniform anymore. She scrutinised the Charlie's Angels jumpsuit I had put on that morning in honour of the occasion. Well, I guess that's something. She pointed Mrs. Laszlo towards the sandwiches. What else could I say? It was a job. Progress of sorts. I didn't tell her about the days when it felt like a peculiar form of torture to work somewhere where I was forced to watch each plane taxi on the runway, gather its energy like a great bird, then launch itself into the sky. I didn't tell her how putting on that green polo shirt each day made me feel somehow as if I had lost something. Mum says you've got a boyfriend. Well, he's not really my boyfriend. She said that as well. What is it then? You just bump uglies once in a while. No, we're good friends. So he's a pig. No, he's not a pig. He's gorgeous. But he's crap in the sack. He's wonderful. Not that it's any of your business. And smart before you... Oh, then he's married. He's not married. Jesus, Trine, will you just let me explain? I like him. But I'm not sure I want to get involved just yet. Because of the long queue of other handsome, employed, single, sexy men waiting to snap you up? I glared at her. I'm just saying. Gift horses and all that. When do you get your exam results? Don't change the subject, she sighed and opened a new carton of milk. A couple of weeks. What's wrong? You're going to get top marks. You know you will. But what's the difference? I'm stuck. I frowned. There are no jobs in Stortford, but I can't afford the rent in London, not with childcare for Tom on top. And nobody gets top dollar when they're first starting out, even with top marks. She poured another cup of tea. I wanted to protest, to say it wasn't so, but I knew only too well how tough the job market was. So what will you do? Stay here for now, I suppose. Commute, maybe. Hope that Mum's feminist metamorphosis won't stop her picking Tom up from school. She raised a small smile that wasn't a smile at all. I'd never seen my sister down. Even if she felt it, she ploughed on like an automaton, a firm advocate of the short walk and snap out of it school of depression. I was trying to work out what to say when there was a sudden commotion on the food table. We looked up to see Mum and Dad facing off over a chocolate cake. They were talking in lowered, sibilant voices of people who did not want others to know they were arguing, but not enough to stop arguing. Mum, Dad, is everything okay? I walked over. Dad pointed at the table. It's not a homemade cake. What? The cake. It's not homemade. Look at it. I looked at it. A large, lavishly iced chocolate cake decorated with chocolate buttons between the candles. Mum shook her head in exasperation. I had an essay to write. An essay? You're not at school. You always do a homemade cake for Grandad. It's a nice cake. It's from Waitrose. Daddy doesn't mind that it's not homemade. Yes, he does. He's your father. You do mind, don't you, Grandad? Grandad looked from one to the other and gave a tiny shake of his head. Around us, the conversation stuttered to a halt. Our neighbours eyed each other nervously. Bernard and Josie Clark never argued. He's just saying that because he doesn't want to hurt your feelings, Dad harrumphed. If his feelings aren't hurt, Bernard, why on earth should yours be? It's a chocolate cake. It's not like I ignored his whole birthday. I just want you to give priority to your family. Is that too much to ask, Josie? One homemade cake. I'm here. There's cake with candles. Here's the ruddy sandwiches.
I'm not off sunning myself in the Bahamas.
Mum put her pile of plates heavily on the trestle table and folded her arms. Dad went to speak again, but she shut him up with a raised hand.
So, Bernard, you devoted family man. You, exactly how much of this little lot did you put together, eh?
Uh-oh, Trina moved a step closer to me.
Did you buy Daddy's new pyjamas? Did you? Did you wrap them? No. You wouldn't even know what bloody size he is. You don't even know what bloody size your own pants are because I buy them for you. Did you get up at 7 o'clock this morning to fetch the bread for the sandwiches because some idiot came back from the pub last night and decided he needed to eat 2 rounds of toast and left the rest of the loaf out to get stale? No. You sat on your ass reading the sports pages. You gripe away at me for weeks on end because I've dared to claim back 20% of my life for myself. To try to work out whether there is anything else I can do before I shuffle off this mortal coil. And while I'm still doing your washing, looking after Grandad and doing the dishes, you're there harping on at me about a shop-bought fecking cake. Well, Bernard, you can take that fecking shop-bought cake that is apparently such a sign of neglect and disrespect, and you can shove it up your... She let out a roar. Up your... Well, there's the kitchen. There's my ruddy mixing bowl. You can make one your ruddy self. With that, Mum flicked the cake plate upwards so that it landed nose down in front of Dad, wiped her hands on her apron, and stomped up the garden to the house. She stopped when she got to the patio, wrenched her apron over her head and threw it to the ground. Oh, yes. Trina, you'd better show Daddy where the recipe books are. He's only lived here 28 years. He can't possibly be expected to know himself.
After that, Grandad's party didn't last long. The neighbours drifting away, conferring in hushed tones and thanking us effusively for the lovely party. Their eyes flickered towards the kitchen. I could see they felt as thrown as I did. It's been brewing for weeks, Trina muttered as we cleared the table. He feels neglected. She can't understand why, and he won't just let her grow a little. I glanced to where Dad was grumpily picking up napkins and empty beer cans from the grass. He looked utterly miserable. I thought of my mother at the London Hotel, glowing with new life. But they're old. They're meant to have all this relationship stuff sewn up. My sister raised her eyebrows. You don't think?
Of course not, said Trina.
But she didn't sound quite as convinced as she might have done. I helped Trina tidy the kitchen and played 10 minutes of Super Mario with Tom. Mum stayed in her room, apparently working on her essay, and Grandad retreated with some relief to the more reliable consolations of Channel 4 racing. I wonder if Dad had gone down the pub again, but as I stepped out of the front door to leave, there he was, sitting in the driver's seat of his work van. I knocked on the window and he jumped. I opened the door and slid in beside him. I thought maybe he was listening to sports results, but the radio was silent. He let out a long breath. I bet you think I'm an old fool. You're not an old fool, Dad. I nudged him. Well, you're not old. We sat in silence watching the Ellis boys wheel up and down the road on their bikes, wincing in unison when the little one took a skid too fast and slid halfway across the road. I want things to stay the same. Is that too much to ask? Nothing stays the same, Dad. I just miss my wife. He sounded so bleak. You know, you could just enjoy the fact that you're married to someone who still has a bit of life in her. Mum's excited. She feels like she's seeing the world through new eyes. You've just got to allow us some room. His mouth was set in a grim line. She's still your wife, Dad. She loves you. He finally turned to face me.
What if she decides that I'm the one with no life? What if all this new stuff turns her head and...
He gulped.
What if she leaves me behind?
I squeezed his hand. Then I thought better and leaned over and gave him a hug. You won't let that happen. The one smile he gave me stayed with me the whole way home. Lily came in just as I was leaving for the moving on circle. She had been with Camilla again and arrived home, as she did often now with black fingernails from gardening. They had created a whole new border for a neighbour, she said cheerfully, and the woman had been so pleased she had given Lily £30. Actually, she gave us a bottle of wine too, but I said Granny should keep that. I noted the unselfconscious Granny. Oh, and I spoke to Georgina on Skype last night. I mean, it was morning there because it's Australia, but it was really nice. She's going to email me a whole load of pictures of when she and my dad were little. She said that I really look like him. She's quite pretty. She has a dog called Jacob, and it howls when she plays the piano. I put a bowl of salad and some bread and cheese on the table for Lily as she chatted on. I wondered whether to tell her that Stephen Traynor had called again, the fourth time in as many weeks, hoping to persuade her to go and see the new baby. We're all family, and Della is feeling much more relaxed about things now that the baby is safely here. Maybe that was a conversation for another time. I reached for my keys. Oh, she said, before you go, I'm going back to school.
What?
I'm going back to the school near Granny's house. Do you remember the one I told you about, the one I actually liked? Weekly boarding, just for sixth form, and I'm going to live with Granny at weekends.
I had missed the leaf with the salad dressing.
Oh, sorry, I did want to tell you, but it's all happened really fast. I was talking about it, and just on the off chance, Granny rang up the school, and they said I'd be welcome. And you'll never guess what, my friend Holly's still there. I spoke to her on Facebook, and she said she can't wait for me to come back. I mean, I didn't tell her everything that's happened, and I probably won't tell her any of it, but it was just really nice. She knew me before it all went wrong. She's just okay, you know? I listened to her talking animatedly and fought the sensation that I had been shed like a skin. When is all this going to happen? Well, I need to be there for the start of term in September. Granny thought it would probably be best if I moved quite soon. Maybe next week?
Next week? I felt winded. What does your mum say?
She's just glad I'm going back to school, especially since Granny's paying. She had to tell the school a bit about my last school and the fact that I didn't take my exams, and you can tell she doesn't like Granny much, but she said it would be fine. If that's actually going to make you happy, Lily, and I do hope you're not going to treat your grandmother the way you treated everyone else. She cackled at her own impression of Tanya. I caught Granny's eye when she said that, and Granny's eyebrow went up the tiniest bit, but you could totally see what she thought. Did I tell you she's dyed her hair, sort of chestnut brown? She looks quite good now, less like a cancer patient. Lily! It's all right. She laughed when I told her that. She smiled to herself. It was the kind of thing Dad would have said.
Well, I muttered when I caught my breath. Sounds like you've got it all worked out. She shot me a look. Don't say it like that. Sorry. It's just, I'll miss you. She beamed an abrupt, brilliant smile.
You won't miss me, silly, because I'll be back down in the holidays and stuff. I can't spend all my time in Oxfordshire with old people. I'll go mad. But it's good. She feels like my family. It doesn't feel weird. I thought it would, but it doesn't.
Hey, Lou.
She hugged me exuberantly. You'll still be my friend. You're basically the sister I never had. I hugged her back and tried to keep the smile on my face. Anyway, you need your privacy. She disentangled herself and pulled a piece of gum from her mouth, folding it carefully into a torn piece of paper. Having to listen to you and hot ambulance man shagging across the corridor was actually pretty gross.
Lily is going.
Going where?
To live with her grandmother. I feel strange. She's so happy about it. Sorry, I don't mean to talk about will-related things all the time, but I can't really talk to anyone else.
Lily packed her bag, cheerfully stripping my second bedroom of nearly every sign she had ever been there, apart from the Kandinsky print and the camp bed, a pile of glossy magazines and an empty deodorant canister. I dropped her at the station, listening to her non-stop chatter and trying not to look as unbalanced as I felt. Camilla Traynor would be waiting at the other end.
You should come up. We've got my room really nice. There's a horse next door that the farmer across the way says I can ride. Oh, and there's quite a nice pub.
She glanced up at the departures board and bounced on her toes, suddenly seeing the time. Bugger! My train! Right! Where's platform 11? She began to run briskly through the crowd, her holdall slung over her shoulder, her legs long in black tights. I stood frozen watching her go. Her stride had grown longer. Suddenly she turned, and spotting me by the entrance waved, her smile wide, her hair flying up around her face.
Hey, Lou! She yelled. I meant to say to you! Moving on doesn't mean you love my dad any less, you know. I'm pretty sure even he would tell you that.
And then she was gone, swallowed by the crowd. Her smile was like his. She was never yours, Lou. I know. I suppose she was the thing I felt was giving me a purpose.
Only one person can give you a purpose.
I let myself absorb these words for a minute. Can we meet, please?
I'm on shift tonight.
We'll come to mine after?
Maybe later in the week. I'll call you.
It was the maybe that did it. There was something final in it. The slow closing of a door. I stared at my phone as the commuters swarmed around me. And something in me shifted too. Either I could go home and mourn yet another thing I had lost, or I could embrace an unexpected freedom. It was as if a light had gone on. The only way to avoid being left behind was to start moving. I went home, made myself a coffee, and stared at the green wall. Then I pulled out my laptop. Dear Mr. Gopnik, my name is Louisa Clark, and last month you were kind enough to offer me a job, which I had to turn down. I appreciate that you will have filled your position by now, but if I don't say this, I will regret it forever. I really wanted your job. If the child of my former employer hadn't turned up in trouble, I would have taken it like a shot. I do not want to blame her for my decision, as it was a privilege to help sort things out for her. But I just wanted to say that if you ever need someone again, I really hope you might consider getting in touch. I know you are a busy man, so I won't go on, but I just needed you to know. With best wishes, Louisa Clark. I wasn't sure what I was doing, but at least I was doing something. I pressed send, and with that tiny action, I was suddenly filled with purpose. I raced into the bathroom and round the shower, stripping off my clothes and tripping on my trouser legs in my hurry to get out of them and under the hot water. I began to lather my hair, already planning ahead. I was going to go to the ambulance station, and I was going to find Sam, and I was... The doorbell rang. I swore and grabbed a towel. "I've had it," my mother said. It took me a moment to register that it was actually her standing there holding an overnight bag. I pulled my towel around me, my hair dripping onto the carpet. "Had what?" She stepped in, closing the front door behind her. "Your father, grumbling incessantly at me about everything I do. Acting as if I'm some kind of harlot just for wanting a little time to myself. So I told him I was coming here for a little break."
"A break?"
"Louisa, you have no idea. All the mumping and grumping. I can't stay set in stone, you know. Everyone else gets to change. Why can't I?"
It was as if I'd come halfway into a conversation that had been going on for an hour, possibly in a bar, after hours.
"When I started that feminist consciousness course, I thought a fair bit of it was exaggerated. Man's patriarchal control of woman. Even the unconscious kind. Well, they only had the half of it. Your father simply can't see me as a person beyond what I put on the table or put out in bed."
Too much. Possibly.
"Let's discuss it over some tea."
My mother walked past me and into the kitchen.
"Well, this looks a bit better. I'm still not sure about that green, though. It washes you right out. Now, where are your tea bags?"
My mother sat on the sofa, and as her tea grew cold, I listened to her litany of frustration and tried not to think about the time. Sam would be arriving for his shift in half an hour. It would take 20 minutes to get over to the ambulance station. And then my mother's voice would lift, and her hands would end up somewhere around her ears, and I knew I was going nowhere.
"Do you know how stifling it is to be told you're never going to be able to change, for the rest of your life, because nobody else wants you to? Do you know how awful it is to feel stuck?"
I nodded vigorously. "I did. I really did." "I'm sure Dad doesn't mean for you to feel like that, but listen, I even suggested he take a course at the night school. Something he might like, you know, repairing antiques or life drawing or something. I don't mind him looking at the nudies. I thought we could grow together. That's the kind of wife I'm trying to be, the kind that doesn't even mind a husband looking at nudies, if it's in the name of culture. But he's all..."
"What would I want to go down there for?"
"It's like he's got the ruddy menopause. And as for the rabbiting on about me not shaving my legs, oh my days, he's so hypocritical. Do you know how long the hairs in his nostrils are, Louisa?"
No.
"I'll tell you. He could wipe his plate with them. For the last 15 years, I've been the one telling the barber to give him a trim up there, you know. Like he's some kind of child. Do I mind? No, because that's the way he is. He's a human being, nose hair and all. But if I dare not to be as smooth as a ruddy baby's bottom, he acts like I've turned into flipping Chewbacca. It was 6:10. Sam would be heading out at 6:30. I sighed and pulled my towel around me. So, how long do you think you'll be here?
Well, now I don't know.
Mum took a sip of her tea. We've got the social services bringing Grandad his lunch now, so it's not like I've got to be there all the time. I might just stay for a few days. We had a lovely time last time I was here, didn't we? We could go and see Maria in the toilets tomorrow. Wouldn't that be nice?
Lovely.
Right. Well, I'll make up the spare bed. Where is the spare bed?
We had just stood up when the buzzer went again. I opened the door, expecting a random pizza delivery, but there stood Trina and Tom, and behind them, his hands jammed into his trouser pockets, like a recalcitrant teenager, my father. She didn't even look at me. She just walked in past me.
Mum, this is ridiculous. You can't just run away from Dad. How old are you? 14?
I'm not running away, Trina. I'm giving myself breathing space.
Well, we're going to sit here until you two have sorted this ridiculous thing out. You know he's been sleeping in his van, Lou?
What? You didn't tell me that.
I turned to Mum. She lifted her chin. You didn't give me a chance with all your talking.
Mum and Dad stood there not looking at each other.
I have nothing to say to your father right now, Mum said.
Sit down, said Trina, the both of you. They shuffled towards the sofa, casting mute glances of resentment at each other. She turned to me.
Right, let's make tea. And then we're going to sort this out as a family.
Great idea, I said, sensing my chance. There's milk in the fridge, tea's on the side. Help yourselves. I've got to pop out for 30 minutes.
And before anyone could stop me, I'd whipped on a pair of jeans and a top and was running out of the flat with my car keys.
I saw him even as I turned the car into the ambulance station car park. He was striding towards the ambulance, his pack slung over his shoulder, and something inside me lurched. I knew the delicious solidity of that body, the soft angles of that face. He turned and his step faltered, as if I had been the last thing he had expected to see. Then he turned back to the ambulance, hauling open the rear doors. I walked towards him across the tarmac. Can we talk? He lifted an oxygen tank like it was a tin of hairspray, securing it in its holder.
Sure, but it'll have to be some other time. I'm on my way out.
It won't wait. His expression didn't flicker. He stooped to pick up a pack of gauze. Look, I just wanted to explain what we were talking about. I do like you. I really like you. I'm just scared.
We're all scared, Lou.
You're not scared of anything.
Yeah, I am. Just not stuff you'd notice.
He stared at his boots, and then he saw Donna running towards him.
Ah, hell, I've got to go.
I jumped into the rear of the ambulance. I'll come with you. I'll get a taxi home from wherever you're headed.
No.
Oh, come on, please.
So I can get in even more trouble with disciplinary.
Red 2, reports of a stabbing young male. Donna threw her pack into the back of the ambulance.
We've got to go, Louisa.
I was losing him. I could feel it in the tone of his voice, the way he wouldn't look at me directly. I climbed out of the back, cursing my lateness. But Donna took me by the elbow and steered me towards the front.
For God's sake, she said as Sam made to protest. You've been like a bear with a sore head all week. Just sort this thing out. We'll drop her off before we get to Kingsbury.
Sam walked briskly round to the passenger door and opened it, casting a glance at the controller's office.
She'd make a great relationship counsellor, his voice hardened. If we were, you know, in a relationship.
I didn't need telling twice. Sam climbed into the driving seat and looked at me as if he were going to say something, then changed his mind. Donna began sorting out equipment. He started the ignition and put the blue light on.
Where are we headed? We are headed to the estate, about 7 minutes away with Blues and Twos. You are headed to the High Street, 2 minutes from Kingsbury.
So I've got 5 minutes.
And a long walk back.
Okay, I said, and realised as we sped forward that I really had no idea what to say next. Chapter 26. So, here's the thing, I said. Sam indicated and swung out onto the road. I had to shout as the siren was so loud. His attention was on the road ahead. He glanced at the computer readout on the dashboard.
What have we got, Don? Possible stabbing. 2 reports. Young male collapsed in stairwell.
Is this really a good time to talk? I said.
Depends what you want to say.
It's not that I don't want a relationship, I said. I just still feel a bit mixed up.
Everyone's mixed up, said Donna. Every bloke I go out with starts our date with how he's got trust issues. She looked at Sam. Oh, sorry, don't mind me. Sam kept his eyes straight ahead. One minute you're calling me a dick because you've decided I'm sleeping with other women. Next, you're keeping me at arm's length because you're still attached to someone else. It's too... Will is gone. I know that. But I just can't leap in like you can, Sam. I feel like I'm only just getting back on my feet after a long time of... I don't know. I was a mess. I know you were a mess. I picked up that mess. If anything, I like you too much. I like you so much that if it went wrong, it would feel like that again. And I'm not sure I'm strong enough. How is that going to happen? You might go off me. You might change your mind. You're a good-looking bloke. Some other woman might fall off a building and land on you and you might like it. You might get ill. You might get knocked off that motorbike. ETA 2 minutes, said Donna, gazing at the sat-nav. I'm not listening, honest. You could say that about anyone. So what? So we sit there and we do nothing every day in case we have an accident? Is that really how to live? He swerved to the left so that I had to hang on to my seat. I'm still a donut, okay? I said. I want to be a bun, I really do. But I'm still a donut. Jesus, Lou, we're all donuts. You think I didn't watch my sister being eaten by cancer and know that my heart was going to break, not just for her but for her son, every day of my life? You think I don't know how that feels? There's only one response, and I can tell you this because I see it every day. You live. You throw yourself into everything and try not to think about the bruises. Oh, that's lovely, said Donna, nodding. I'm trying, Sam. You have no idea how far I've come. And then we were there. The sign for Kingsbury Estate loomed in front of us. We drove in through the huge archway past a car park and into a darkened courtyard, where Sam pulled up and swore softly. Damn it, we were meant to drop you off. I didn't like to interrupt, said Donna. I'll wait here till you get back. I crossed my arms. There's no point. Sam jumped out of the driver's door and grabbed his pack. I'm not going to jump through hoops to convince you to be with me. Oh, crap. The bloody signs are missing. He could be anywhere. I gazed out at the forbidding maroon brick buildings. There were probably 20 stairwells in those blocks, and none you would have wanted to walk around without the company of a large bodyguard. Donna shrugged away into her jacket. Last time I came here, heart attack, took 4 tries to find the right block, and that gate was locked. We had to find a caretaker to unlock it before we could bring in the mobile unit. By the time I made it to the right flat, the patient was dead. 2 gang shootings here last month. You want me to call a police escort? Said Donna. No, no time. It was eerily quiet, even though it was barely 8 p.m. These were estates in a part of the city where only a few years ago, children might have been playing out on bikes, sneaking cigarettes and catcalling long into the evening. Now, residents double-locked their doors long before dark, and windows were braced with decorative metal bars. Half the sodium lights had been shot out, and the odd remaining one flickered intermittently, as if uncertain whether it was safe to shine. Sam and Donna, now outside the cab, were talking, their voices lowered. Donna opened the passenger door, reached in and handed me a high-visibility jacket. Right, put that on and come with us. He doesn't feel safe leaving you here. Why couldn't he? Oh, you two, for God's sake! Look, I'm going to head this way. You follow in that way, okay? I stared at her. Sort it out afterwards. She strode off, her walkie-talkie buzzing in her hand. I followed close behind Sam as we went along one length of concrete walkway, then another. Savernake House, he muttered. How the hell are we supposed to know which one is Savernake? The radio hissed. Control, can we have some guidance? No signs on these buildings and I have no idea where the patient is. Sorry, the voice said back apologetically. Our map doesn't show individual block names. Do you want me to head off that way? I said, pointing in front of us. Then we'll have 3 walkways covered. I've got my phone with me. We halted in a stairwell that reeked of urine and the stale fat of old takeaway cartons. The walkway sat in shadow. Only the occasional muffled burble of a television behind the window suggesting life deep within each small flat. I had expected a distant commotion, some vibration in the air that would lead us to the injured. But this was eerily still. No, stay close, okay? I saw that having me there was making him nervous. I wondered whether I should just leave, but I didn't want to find my way out by myself. Sam stopped at the end of the walkway. He turned, shaking his head, his mouth compressed. Donna's voice crackled across the radio. Nothing this end. Then we heard a shout. There, I said, following the sound. On the other side of the square, in the half-light, we saw a crouching figure, a body, on the ground under the sodium lights.
Here we go, said Sam, and we started to run.
Speed was everything in his job, he had once told me. It was one of the first things paramedics were taught, the difference a few seconds could make to someone's chances of survival. If the patient was bleeding out, had had a stroke or a heart attack, it could be those critical few seconds that kept them alive. We bolted along the concrete walkways, down the reeking, dingy stairs, and then we were across the worn grass towards the prostrate figure. Donna was already down beside her.
A girl. Sam dropped his pack. I'm sure they said it was a man.
As Donna checked for her injuries, he called into control.
Yep, young male, late teens, Afro-Caribbean appearance, the dispatcher responded.
Sam clicked off his radio.
They must have misheard. It's like bloody Chinese whispers some days.
She was about 16, her hair neatly braided, her limbs sprawled as if she had recently fallen. She was strangely peaceful. I wondered fleetingly if that was how I had looked when he'd found me.
Can you hear me, sweetheart?
She didn't move. He checked her pupils, her pulse, her airways. She was breathing and there was no obvious sign of injury. Yet she seemed completely non-responsive. He checked all around her a second time, staring at his equipment. Is she alive? Sam's eyes met Donna's. He straightened up and glanced around him, thinking. He gazed up at the windows of the estate. They stared down at us like blank, unfriendly eyes. Then he motioned us over and spoke quietly. Something's not right. Look, I'm going to do the drop hand test, and when I do, I want you to head for the rig and start the engine. If it's what I think it is, we need to get out of here.
Jug's ambush, muttered Donna, her gaze sliding behind me.
Might be, or turf-related. We should have a location match. I'm sure this is where Andy Gibson had that shooting.
I tried to keep my voice calm.
What's the drop hand test?
I'm going to lift her hand and drop it from above her face.
If she's acting, she'll move her hand rather than hit her own face. They always do. It's like a reflex. But if there's someone watching, I don't want them to get wind that we've worked it out. Louisa, you act like you're going to get some more equipment, okay? I'll do it once you've texted me to say you're at the rig. If anyone's near it, don't go in. Just turn around and come straight back to me. Donna, get your pack together and ready. You go after her. If they see two of us leaving together, they'll know.
He handed me the keys. I picked up a bag, as if it were mine, and started to walk briskly towards the ambulance. I was suddenly conscious of unseen people watching from the shadows. My heartbeat was thumping in my ears. I tried to make my face expressionless, my movements purposeful. The walk along the echoing concourse felt achingly long. When I reached the ambulance, I let out a sigh of relief. I reached for the keys, opened the door, and as I stepped up, a voice called from the shadows.
Miss!
I glanced behind me. Nothing.
Miss!
A young boy appeared from behind a concrete pillar, another behind him, a hoodie pulled forward to obscure his face. I took a step back towards the rig, my heart racing.
I've got backup on the way, I said, trying to keep my voice steady. There's no drugs in here. You both need to back off, okay?
Miss, he's by the bins. They don't want you to get to him. He's bleeding real bad, miss. That's why Amika's cousin is faking it out there. To distract yous, so yous will go away.
What? What do you mean?
He's by the bins. You gotta help him, miss.
What? Where are the bins?
But the boy glanced warily behind him, and when I turned to ask again, they had disappeared into the shadows. I glanced around, trying to work out where he meant, and then I spied it, over by the garages, the protruding edge of a bright green plastic rubbish container. I edged along the shadows of the ground floor walkway, out of view of the main square, until I saw an open doorway out to the refuse area. I ran over, and there, tucked behind the recycling bin, a pair of legs sprawled, tracksuit bottoms soaked with blood. His upper half was slumped under the containers and I crouched down. The boy turned his head and groaned quietly.
Hello? Can you hear me?
They got me.
Blood seeped stickily from what looked like two wounds to his legs. They got me.
I grabbed my phone and called Sam, my voice low and urgent.
I'm over by the bins, to your right. Please, come quick.
I could see him looking around slowly until he spotted me. Two elderly people, Samaritans from a previous age, had appeared beside him. I could see them asking questions about the fallen girl,
their faces blanketed with concern. He gently placed a blanket over the faking cousin, asking them to watch over her, then walked briskly towards the rig with his bag, as if to get more equipment. Donna had vanished. I opened the bag he'd given me, ripping open a pack of gauze and placing it over the boy's leg. But there was so much blood. "Okay, someone's coming to help. We'll have you in the ambulance in a moment." I sounded like someone out of a bad film. I had no idea what else to say. "Oh, come on, Sam. You've got to get me out of here," the boy groaned. I put my hand on his arm, trying to keep calm. "Come on, Sam, where the hell are you?" And suddenly, I heard the rig's engine starting, and there it was, reversing through the garages towards me, at some speed, its engine whining in protest. It bumped to a halt and Donna jumped out. She ran towards me, threw open the back doors. "Help me put him in," she said. "We're getting out of here." There was no time for gurneys. Somewhere above, I heard shouting, multiple footsteps. We shouldered the boy towards the ambulance, shoving him into the back. Donna slammed the doors behind him and I ran for the cab, my heart racing, and threw myself in, locking the doors. I could see them now. A gang of men racing towards us around the upper floor, hands raised with, what, guns? Knives? I felt something grow liquid inside me. I looked out of the window. Sam was walking along the open space, his face turned to the sky. He had seen them too. Donna saw before he did. The gun, raised in the man's hand. She swore loudly and slammed the rig into reverse, steering it round the garage, headed straight for the grassed area where Sam was still walking towards us. I could just make him out, the green of his uniform growing larger in the passenger mirror. "Sam!" I yelled out of my window. He glanced at me, then up at them. "Leave the ambulance alone!" he yelled at the men, over the whine of the ambulance's reversing gear. "Back off, all right? We're just doing our jobs." "Not now, Sam, not now," Donna said under her breath. The men kept running, peering over as if calculating the quickest way down, relentless, moving forward like a tide. One vaulted nimbly over a wall, swinging his way easily down a flight of stairs. I wanted to skid out of there so badly I was limp with it. But Sam was still walking towards them, his hands raised, palms up. "Leave the ambulance, boys, okay? We're just here to help." His voice was calm and authoritative, betraying none of the fear that I felt. And then I saw through the back window that the men had slowed. They were walking now, not running. A distant part of me thought, "Oh, thank God." The boy lay behind us, still moaning. "That's it," said Donna, leaning around. "Come on, Sam. In you come. Come on over here now, and we can get the bang." The sound cut through the air, amplified in the empty space, so that I felt, briefly, as if my whole head had expanded and contracted with the sound. And then, too quickly, bang! I yelped. "What the f—" Donna yelled. "We need to get out of here, man," the boy shouted. I looked back, willing Sam to get in. "Get in now, please." But Sam had gone. No, not gone. There was something on the ground. A high-visibility jacket. A yellow stain on the grey concrete. Everything stopped. "No," I thought. "No." The ambulance screeched to a halt. Then Donna was out, and I was running after her. Sam was motionless, and there was blood. So much blood seeping outwards in a steadily expanding pool around him. In the distance, the two old people scrambled stiffly towards the safety of their door, the girl who was supposedly immobile sprinting across the grass at the speed of an athlete. And the men were still coming, running down the upper walkway towards us. I tasted metal in my mouth. "Lou, grab him!" We hauled Sam towards the back of the rig. He was leaden, as if he were deliberately resisting. I pulled at his collar, his armpits, my breath coming in short bursts. His face was chalk white. Huge black shadows under his half-closed eyes, as if he had not slept for 100 years. His blood against my skin. Why had I not known how warm blood is? Donna was already in the rig, hauling at him, and we were pushing, heaving, a sob in my throat as I pulled at his legs. "Help me!" I was shouting, as if there were anyone who could. "Help me!" And then he was in, his leg at the wrong angle, and the door slammed behind me. Crack! Something hit the top of the rig. I screamed and ducked. Some part of me thought absently, "Is this it? Is this how I die?"